Well, with falling rates, lower inflation, and what looks like a soft landing, the latest Global Financial Stability Report, or GFSR, says near-term risks are contained, but
we are worried about the disconnect between this fairly buoyant financial market sentiment with the fact that there's a lot of economic uncertainty in the world.
So it's therefore very critical for emerging markets to continue to pursue structural reforms and to preserve and enhance their resilience to external shocks.
Jason Wu is an assistant director and Nasira Abbas, a division chief in the Monetary and Capital Markets Department. They lead the IMF's work on financial stability and produce the GFSR. So we do this every 6 months, and it's always interesting to me to see if any of the risks that were top of mind then are still around, like inflation, for example. Is inflation still a stability risk in this new report? Given the falling interest rates now.
Well, thanks for having us, Bruce. Great question. The answer is it is still a concern for global financial stability, but less so compared to 6 months ago. And this is because we have seen continued progress on disinflation in most major economies. In fact, according to the World Economic Outlook, inflation is now within the percentage point of central banks' targets in most of these countries. But what we have learned in the post-pandemic years, of course, is that inflation dynamics turned out to be more complicated than economists thought they would be. There are a lot of supply-side concerns. Investor expectations of inflation can gyrate a lot as well. And so with that, this means that surprises to inflation remains very much a risk to both financial markets as well as to financial stability.
So the inflation sort of easing up has helped confidence in the markets, and the markets have been doing pretty well, surprisingly well, I think some would say, with some advanced economies like the US and Canada seeing very large equity gains. But something happened in August that suggests that things aren't quite as stable as they seem. And I was surprised to learn how it was a decision by the Bank of Japan that actually sparked the whole episode. How did that play out? And what does it tell us about the state of equity markets?
Yeah, again, very good question. Let's take a step back a little bit. With inflation progress continued, since we had this conversation last time, and the global economy remained fairly robust. I mean, there are good reasons for financial markets to be celebrating this through, higher stock prices, tighter bond spreads. And of course, we should also keep in mind that because of these developments, monetary policy is also easing. And when interest rates are coming down, that's generally good for assets and for the economy. So a lot of progress has been made. And, this is consistent with the assessment in our report this time that near-term financial stability risk appears contained. But as you point out, Bruce, we are worried about the disconnect between this fairly buoyant financial market sentiment. Overall investor confidence is very high, with the fact that there's a lot of economic uncertainty in the world. There's a lot of political uncertainty in the world. And of course, geopolitical risk, given ongoing conflicts, is at an elevated level. So one concern, of course, is that these assets are now priced to perfection, so to speak. And it does not account for the chance that, for example, disinflation might be appended by, an intensification in certain wars through oil prices, et cetera. And in August, I think we've actually seen, the potential mayhem that could happen when low volatility starts to catch up to this high level of economic uncertainty. You're right that the Bank of Japan played a role in this, but it wasn't the only factor. So what happened was the Bank of Japan has started to increase interest rates as inflation is starting to appear in Japan. The yen has started to strengthen over the summer. And then what happened was in early August, we got a not-so-favorable labor market report. Still solid numbers, but less favorable than before, labor market report in the U.S., indicating that there might be a slowdown in the U.S. economy. So what this did was that this narrowed the perception of what the interest difference would be between U.S. and Japan. When that happens, the yen would appreciate. And when the yen appreciates, usually when we see these type of you know, very drastic movements in stock markets. By the way, on August 5th, the Nikkei dropped by 12%.
Wow.
It tripped the circuit breaker a few times, right? So it's a tremendous amount of drops, biggest since 1987. When this kind of flashy type of event happens, usually this signals that, you know, there's some lopsided bets, right, in financial markets before that. And connecting to my yen story here, this time the lopsided bet seems to be so-called carry trades, which are essentially investors borrowing yen under the pretense that yen were cheap, interest rates in Japan were low, to invest in things like stocks, invest in things like, you know, emerging market currencies. And so when the combination of Bank of Japan and the labor report in the U.S. happened, this perception that the yen will continue to be weak is upended. And a lot of people left these trades abruptly. This means dumping the stocks that they were purchased, using the cheap yen. And this led to quite a drastic impact in stock markets. Now, fortunately for us, this episode was relatively short-lived. And as far as we could tell, there was no broader financial stability ramifications so far. However, it shows that, you know, when you have fairly lopsided bets coupled with low volatility in markets, investors may be very complacent, how quickly certain events can spark, you know, a catch-up of volatility to uncertainty.
Yeah, it's so interesting how one event can change things overnight. And today, basically, the markets are back like nothing ever happened in August.
Exactly.
So Nasira, in last spring's report, emerging market economies were lauded for their proven resilience throughout all the shocks over the past few years, and there have been many. But now with China's continuing slowdown, and as Jason just mentioned, the geopolitical tensions a little bit everywhere, are emerging markets still well positioned to sort of survive the trade tensions and everything else that goes with the instability?
So emerging markets have continued generally to demonstrate resilience since the last report, managing to withstand pressure in their currencies, especially in August, as Jason has explained, there was a lot of volatility on financial market. Mm-hmm. However, the external environment for some countries is indeed becoming more challenging, despite the declining interest rate we are experiencing today. So in the report, you like to distinguish near-term versus medium-term risks. And in the near-term, geopolitical tension, as you mentioned, are rising, and uncertainty around economic fragmentation are also creating significant challenges for many countries. And in the meantime, slower growth in advanced economies could also further complicate the growth outlook for some emerging markets. So market participants are particularly concerned about how these developments might impact commodity prices, broader risky asset, and consequently funding and financial condition for emerging market. And when we look at the relationship between advanced economies and emerging market, we observed a high sensitivity of for instance, in the bond yield market, high sensitivity of bond yields to advanced economies bond markets. So an increase in, for instance, in the term premium in emerging market is really resulting from a spillover effect from the U.S. term premium, for instance. So there is a kind of important sensitivity of what is happening in advanced economies versus the emerging market. And when you look at now at the medium term, so there is one important key priority we highlighted already in the GFSR in April, and we reiterate this time around, is fiscal consolidation. So debt sustainability remains a serious concern. So we have long-term growth prospect very weak versus still very high interest rate.
But the interest rates are coming down.
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. But still, they remain very, very high compared to historical standard. Mm-hmm. So an emerging market with weaker fiscal buffer could continue to face some challenges going forward. And so financial markets are really sensitive to these domestic developments, and they try to differentiate countries with weak fiscal buffers versus countries with strong fiscal buffers.
Yeah, and maybe on China specifically, to what extent do financial risks there become global risks?
Yeah, definitely. China is a major player in global trade. And the slowing growth outlook and fragility in its financial system is definitely a downside risk to the global economy. Mm-hmm. And we have highlighted at the IMF in the previous work that financial shock in China can have some repercussion in other countries, and especially through a shock in risky assets such as commodity and market in country with strong trade ties with China can be also in a very complicated situation. So concerns surrounding weakening demand in China, sluggish growth, and especially the adjustment in the property sector have been really affecting investor sentiments for a while now. And we highlighted this risk in many GFSRs, focusing more on the property sector, but this time we are also highlighting some other risks linked to the banking sector. But generally, so we think that national authorities have the tool to address all these risks, and they have already taken steps and announced several measures to reduce further risks. But so the authorities have announced recently a stimulus package, and this action actually have sparked some optimism in financial markets, and so it has already led to a resurgence of capital flows, especially in the equity market. So while this recent market rebound was a really positive sign, it's also very early to assess exactly the implication in terms of what would be the sustainable path of this the stimulus announcement.
So you just mentioned there commercial real estate, which has been a concern everywhere pretty much since the pandemic, and it's not going away. In fact, this report says the pressures on the commercial real estate sector remain acute. So maybe, Jason, what's the issue there, and how can a real estate problem, or at least a problem in one specific sector, turn into a stability risk on a global scale?
So we should remember that the previous financial crisis 15 years ago now was sparked by real estate market.
Right.
Now, commercial real estate is not as large as residential real estate mm-hmm. market, which was the problem back then. The concern from our end, based on our analysis, is that it's basically a double whammy. On the one hand, you have lots of debt that was taken out, you know, during the pandemic to finance these commercial real estate properties. And on the other hand, the structural demand for these properties are lower. You know, many of us now work from home at least a few days a week.
Right.
And so just to give some numbers, globally, $2.4 trillion of commercial real estate loan is due in 2024 and 2025. So over the rest of you know, this year and next year. Some office markets, on the other hand, have vacancies of 20 to 30%. So historically high vacancy rates.
Yeah.
These set of dual challenges has resulted in defaults rising for a number of commercial real estate borrowers, and strains are reflected through, you know, some other metrics such as the stock prices of real estate investment trusts that specializes in investing in commercial real estate. Non-bank lenders, other types of non-bank lenders like you know, commercial mortgage-backed security vehicles
right.
have also seen more strains. And so it is really this dual set of challenges of, you know, the debt that's coming due as well as structurally lower demand that's making us believe that, you know, some of these financial institutions may come under pressure, right? And that includes certain banks as well. Certain small banks, both in the U.S. as well as abroad, have fairly concentrated exposures in commercial real estate. I think the fundamental improvement that's needed here is that commercial real estate demand needs to improve. And that's a tall order in the new post-pandemic world where we just have overall less need, right, for office buildings, shopping malls, et cetera. Lenders and borrowers have so far been finding ways to avoid costly defaults. And for us, this is good news. They're finding ways to sort of like resolve this debt in a healthy way. But, you know, you cannot solve a problem by, you know, working on the debt only. Demand side must also come into play.
Right. And I might, I mean, we've been talking about the risks associated with non-banks for several years now. And so this commercial real estate issue, there is a non-bank element to all this, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So I think the broader trend after the financial crisis is that, you know, the world has moved from a bank-dominated financial system to 50-50, right, banks and non-banks. And, you know, specific to the commercial real estate sector, there are the investment trusts, there are private equity firms that are buying these properties, there are, you know, commercial mortgage-backed security vehicles that are doing these kind of transactions. And they are big players. But I think, you know, to your broader point, Bruce, is that in a way, non-banks gaining more market share in financial markets is healthy in the sense that, you know, it helps limit the concentration of risk within the banking system. We are all depositors here, so we don't want the banking system to be overly leveraged or risky. So having some diversification outside of the banking system is welcome news. On the flip side, though, we all have a certain degree of confidence that banks are fairly well-regulated, right? Of course, last year, there were a couple of high-profile cases where that wasn't the case. But in general, I think, you know, banks are well-capitalized. They have ample liquidity. They're well-supervised. Information is just much more abundant in the banking world. Whereas non-banks, because of how new they are, because of their nature, the same can't be said, right? So there's more opacity in general in that sector. Mm. There is perhaps leverage and hidden risks that we are not seeing. And so the report actually go through a number of steps that supports, you know, current international efforts to gain more visibility into the sector and provide more or less proportionate response, right, policy-wise in terms of supervision and regulation, you know, to the rise of non-banks. Mm. By proportion, I mean, on the one hand, recognizing that they are not deposit-taking institutions. So, you know, the banking regulations may not be perfectly suitable to them. But on the other hand, they need to be accountable and be regulated as well to a certain extent.
Oh, interesting. And finally, technology. So there is a separate analytical chapter in this report that looks at the potential impact of artificial intelligence on the financial system. People can find that on the website, but Nasira, maybe you can give us a little preview to wrap things up here.
Yeah, so the IMF has been looking into AI in finance in general for quite some time now. So we also look at other aspects of artificial intelligence, of course, mm-hmm. but particularly in finance. So and this time we have this analytical chapter. And in this chapter, we dive into how AI is changing capital market particularly and what that means for financial stability. So it's important that regulators and supervisors adapt to this changing landscape, and it's really crucial for policymakers to balance the benefit of AI, because so we also want to support the innovation, but in the meantime to balance the risk and to put in place measures to ensure a stable and efficient financial system.
Mm. And it seems a long list of risks associated with artificial intelligence, and I assume that the Global Financial Stability Report will be focusing on this for years to come.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nasira Abbas and Jason Wu lead the IMF's work on financial stability and produce the Global Financial Stability Report. Thanks to you both.
Thank you
so much for having us.
Thank you, Bruce.
Jason Wu is an assistant director and Nasira Abbas, a deputy division chief, both in the Monetary and Capital Markets Department. You'll find this latest Global Financial Stability Report at imf.org/GFSR. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.